Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. We are learning more about programs in Hawaii that are affected by executive orders handed down by the Trump administration. This time, it's a wildfire safety project on the Big Island. A program that helps the homeless get back to their families on the continent is looking for permanent funding. We learn lessons from a successful diabetes management program at Queens, how patient navigators can help build trust in medicine. On today's Manu Minute, we introduce you to a duck you've likely seen in your backyard, and we hear about a tribute to the late Kris Kristofferson. The documentary short film, One Man, One Voice, is winning awards across the pond. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. You know, HPR first reported on a number of climate projects that are on hold due to President Trump's executive orders freezing federal funds in areas that don't line up with his administration's policies. HPR's Savannah Harriman-Pote joins us today with more news about a Big Island fire safety program that's supposed to reduce the risk of wildfires. Good morning, Savannah.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so you were able to go on site there on the Big Island. What did you see?
Yes, so I was contacted by the Wildfire Safety Advocates of Waikoloa, and they've been working to get a series of kiawe trees that are under a particularly dangerous power line just above Waikoloa Village removed. So they took me out there to see where the project site was and show me why this project matters. I was taken out by the Wildfire Safety Advocates of Waikoloa's Executive Director, Matt Chalker.
Our grant was to remove all of these trees that are right there along the lines. And then it's up and over the hill this way. There's another 10, 15 trees down that way. So we've got a number of mature kiawe trees between, 20 and 30 feet high. Now that I'm looking at them, I haven't walked out here in a couple of months, honestly. I can see actually two or three of them are fully encroaching on the lines. They're actually touching them over there. And they exist under the easement for the power lines. We're currently standing on, they call it the utility easement access road. The actual road is only about 30 to 40 feet wide, maybe two blades width. And then there's just houses right on the other side of it. One side is power lines and open field with kiawe trees underneath the power lines. And the other side is people's backyards. These power lines, they're called the Waikoloa 12 lines. There are transmission lines. They're 69,000 volt lines operated by HECO. And HECO, in their last wildfire safety strategy document that just was released a couple weeks ago, ranked these as the fourth most dangerous lines in the state. They're the most dangerous lines on the Big Island of Hawaii. The first three are all on West Maui in the state.
Wow. So after what we went through with West Maui, these high voltage lines, they're a problem.
Yes, and the Wildfire Safety Advocates of Waikoloa actually formed in the wake of the tragedy in Lahaina to ensure that something like that never happened in their community. And Waikoloa Village, it sits on the west side of Hawaii Island. It's extremely fire-prone. For instance, there was a striking detail about Waikoloa in the Phase 2 Lahaina Fire Incident Analysis Report, which was prepared by our Department of the Attorney General. And they said that Waikoloa's risk of wildfire was 100% higher than any other place in the U.S., and even slightly above Lahaina. Lahaina has a 98% risk higher than any other place in the U.S.
So these trees really need to get cut back.
Yeah, and this is something that the Wildfire Safety Advocates of Waikoloa had been partnering with Hawaiian Electric in order to do. They had received a $75,000 grant from the utility, which is part of the bigger investment HECO is making in wildfire prevention. That $190 million investment, $95 million of which came from the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act via the Federal Department of Energy. And I was speaking to Matt Chalker. He said that on January 27, he was finalizing the paperwork to get the contractors in to remove these trees. But on January 28th, the utility received a memorandum from the Department of Energy saying that it needed to immediately cease any activities using federal funds for DEI, community benefit plans, or Justice 40 initiatives. And it references a specific executive order from Trump titled Ending Radical and Wasteful Department DEI Programs and Preferencing. And so that suspended the $75,000 that this group was in line for in order to get those Piave trees removed. They were a community benefit plan. So now they've kind of found themselves left in the lurch.
So what do we do now?
Well, I reached out to HECO because I wanted to know how broadly had their funding been suspended. And they were able to confirm that they had 11 community benefit projects for which they had earmarked about $1 million in federal funds. So two of those are already under contract for about $300,000. And the utility said that it's going to just pay that cost up front. But that doesn't include the Waikoloa project. And the utility said it wants to continue to work on finding funding opportunities for the other nine projects, even if that means going ahead without federal support. Matt Chalker and then another wildfire safety advocate, Bob Yonke, said HECO has been a great partner in trying to get those Tiave removed in Waikoloa. And Yonke believes it's in the utility's best interest for this project to move forward.
They ended up being held responsible for billions of dollars of losses in Lahaina. And they don't want to incur that kind of liability again. So they're committed to finding ways of reducing the likelihood that their lines are going to start more fires. And so they know that these trees have to come out of here. They wanted us to be involved, to play a role in helping to make sure it got done right. And it's what we're talking about here is a $75,000 commitment to save $3.5 billion worth of residential development in this village. You know, the houses in this village are worth about $3.5 billion. And then the businesses and other activities, the school and the firehouse and the other things that are at risk of fire here are another billion. So we're talking $4.5-5 billion worth of investment that would be partially protected by investing $75,000. And what the administration is saying is that $75,000 is waste and abuse. And that is just outrageous.
So what's our way around this? Is there any way to appeal this executive order at all, or what do we do?
So the wildfire safety advocates, they've reached out to their congressional representatives. They actually sent me a letter that they had forwarded to Senator Mazie Hirono. They're tracking the lawsuits that the state is involved in. The state is involved in litigation around the Trump administration's federal freeze. And the Department of Attorney General has issued guidance in response to the White House's DEI orders. I reached out to the AG's office to confirm if they are involved or planning any specific litigation on this executive order cited in the memorandum from the Department of Energy to Hawaiian Electric. But the group is also saying, you know, $75,000, we may be able to make that up if other funders step forward. They're very committed to getting these trees removed. And the majority of that money was going to go towards was contractors who could remove the trees themselves, so cut them down, arborists, and then a big community work day where members of the community, wildfire safety advocates, Hawaiian Electric came out and hauled that wood out of that area to make sure that it's entirely clear and safe.
So the idea is remove the immediate threat and then figure out how we pay for it later?
Well, I don't think they're going to go ahead without the funding, but they are looking for folks who could potentially support the funding if HECO isn't able to come through with additional money. But one of the reasons why they're so frustrated about being left in the lurch on this project is the wildfire safety advocates have been working on big initiatives to try to make Waikoloa safer in the face of fire. New evacuation routes, ensuring water access, and this, according to Matt Chalker, really felt like low-hanging fruit, and now they may not be able to get this done or get this done as they intended, and they're worried about what's going to happen to Waikoloa in the upcoming fire season.
All right. Well, we appreciate you tracking this, Savannah. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Catherine.
We've been talking to HPR Savannah Harriman-Pote. You can read her stories online on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz.
Unihoa, Ulehua, Unihau, Ukawai, Oahu, Umolokai, Ulanai, Umau, Ukaholabe, Uhawaii.
For today's backyard quiz, we're testing your knowledge of our official state symbols here in Hawaii. Many of you probably already know that the nene is the state bird and that the yellow Hawaiian hibiscus or Puamoa hauhele is the state flower. We have a state plant, a state bird, a butterfly, and mammal. But did you know we also have an official state gem? It's a tree-like coral that's quite common to the islands. This gem is a relative to the sea anemone and has a trademark skeleton look to it. Its nooks and crannies provide shelter and food and protection to a range of small creatures. The gem can be found throughout the oceans, but it prefers deep waters, staying away from brackish waters near the shoreline. They tend to grow in areas where undersea currents flow, where they can feed on the invertebrates there that are swept by. Can you tell us the name of this state gem? Call 808-941-3689 or toll free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets an HPR reusable tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nereid Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing affordable housing for young farmers seeking a future in agriculture, such as the Waianae Community Redevelopment Corporation. NereidHawaii.com.
Today, we take a closer look at a pilot program called Return to Home. It uses state money to relocate homeless on our streets, and that could mean finding more stable housing in other communities, including other states. Hawaii lawmakers are considering a bill that would make the project permanent. House Bill 212 passed its first hurdle this session and is still advancing. The conversation, C.W. Gibson sat down with the Institute for Human Services, the nonprofit that administers the program. He spoke with Sarah Sato, Outreach Coordinator, Castro Masani-I, Program Manager, and Angie Knight, the Community Relations Manager for IHS. Sato outlines who might be eligible for this program.
So anyone that is unsheltered or at risk, anyone that is also financially, will be financially responsible for half of the airfare, and then that has a point of contact going to other side. So any of those unsheltered or at-risk people, when they put in their application, we see if they have the point of contact would be some they wanted to return home to their family, which could be outer island, mainland, or even international. And so we have the application, and if anyone is interested in going back to where they have family or continuing treatment, it would be through the relocation program.
And I know other cities have had programs to relocate houseless individuals. New York, for instance, provided one-way bus tickets as far back as 1987. But the Return to Home program here in Hawaii seems to be much more than a bus ticket, as you just alluded to. Walk us through some of the steps that IHS takes to increase the chances that some measure of stability awaits the houseless individual once they reach their destination.
So when I look at the application that comes in, we always check for those 3 points, but the main is always the point of contact. So I have to call to confirm that they have someone on the other side that they're going back to. So it would be like a family member, and then I would call and then just confirm that your family had put in an application to relocate back home. And then what is the plan? So they have to have a plan going back there. Like it's usually too expensive here in Hawaii. So we are wanting to go back to our family and where we have support. And there we can like find job and more stability for them. But it's always looking at each application. Also, they could go to a treatment center that it doesn't have to be family or friends, because at IHS we have a detox program, and then that helps them if they're continuing treatment after detoxing here, they can continue and go there. And we've had some cases that have gone to Ohio that once they finish detox here, they've gone on to there, and just confirming that they're going to pick them up and that they have a bed space there.
You mentioned something about shared financial responsibility. Talk a little bit more, too, about that in terms of what kind of buy-in you get from family members once you've made contact with them.
For the relocation, they have to, I always quote the fare, and we use like the best available fare, and they were responsible for half of it, half of the payment. Once I quoted, so just say like a flight would be to Los Angeles, $165, it'll be half of that, and then the family is able to say yes, that they can afford it. If they're not, if it's the guest that's paying or the client, then they can give it to me directly and meet me and then do either a cash or a money order. If their family member is paying for it, then we do Western Union. And then once that I receive the money, then I can also book the flight. So they can do it that way if they're not on island.
Angie, if you could let us know, how many people have gone through the program so far?
Yeah, so the bill was passed in 2023, and I just want to say that though the bill was passed and created into an act, it didn't become a program with a contract until the following year. Since that contract began, it's been 137 individuals, but there's also more work that goes into it that Sarah does. And so there is over 180 applicants. And so sometimes people don't make the cut.
Some people just disappear. Like I call back the number and then nobody's answering. Others are, they decided they just want to stay for some reason. Maybe they found employment so they can sustain a living here. There's others that their family member was going to take them in, but just decided something happened through communication that they'll have to find another route. We can still work with the client as long as they're willing to, but once they say no, then it ends.
It's a reminder that you're working with very vulnerable individuals in very fluid situations, it sounds
yes.
like. And Angie, can you tell me anything in terms of success rate? You've mentioned how many people have gone through the program, but have you been able to track how many of those individuals are able to stay in the situation that you're able to get them to?
There are some people that do take our program, they leave, and then they do come back. But there is also protocol for that. But I know that when we talk about this program, and it really is cost effective, and it really is helping people in cycles of homelessness, and it is doing all these good things, but we have to acknowledge the reality that we're working with people, like you said, that do have free will, because we all have free will, and they do have these options. And so some of them do decide to come back.
Tell us a little bit about the cost of the program and how that might compare to potential long-term savings for the state in terms of caring for these individuals.
Since it started, it's been $22,000 in airfare, us paying half, which is very minimal compared to all of our other services. When you think about our clients, some of these people are high utilizers of emergency departments, of EMS, of CORE. Some of them are going to the crisis center down in Ivele. Some of them are going to all these other things that just cost a lot given the high need. And so we're helping them connect to community, because we at IHS like to say that you can't heal in isolation, and we grow in community. And change only happens if you feel confident in the change, and you need that fostering of community.
Sarah, I would like to get perspective from you as someone helping to run this program. Could you just maybe give us a word or two about what that experience is like?
So not every application is you go in, yes or no, book the flight, and they go home with their family or, you know, go on to treatment. It's not just one shot and then there you go, success. Each application that comes in is different, and you have to just look at it, and it could be ongoing. There was one that we opened up maybe in the summer of last year, and he finally went home in January. So it was like an ongoing working with multiple people. It could be some cases that we work with multiple agencies, multiple people to get one person home.
Angie, I know that there is 3 years of funding for the program, and I know that now there are two bills in the state legislature on the House side, HB 212, mm-hmm. and on the Senate side, 360, that are looking to possibly extend the program past its initial 3 years. Is IHS rolling out any campaigns or efforts to sort of help support those bills that are in play?
There's been a lot of attention on this program as we talk more and more about who the identity of our homeless population is. A lot of what my role is just educating and informing the community and saying these are people with stories. And I've heard through my role different people talking about how they came to be here with their long distance partner and they just never showed up. Or they came here because they thought that they could go into this inpatient program and they closed the waitlist and never told them. These are heartbreaking stories. And so a lot of what IHS is doing right now is just trying to educate and share some of these stories to get some more compassion in the community and more understanding that this program we want to be made permanent because our role, what we see in the community is that we are trying to end cycles of homelessness. And this is a very, sometimes it takes a long time, but this is a very clear way to end cycles of homelessness because we're connecting people with places where they can grow and they can be in support.
Castro, help listeners understand the population you're serving and where they're coming from and some of the sort of perspectives and narratives you've come across.
You know, for us, we want to make sure that we try to get them connected to the right services. Because I feel like that's one thing that our agency does well in is the triage part, right? It's not really like a one size fit all for everybody, right? Everybody's going to have a unique story, unique problem. Therefore, it requires its own unique solution, right? So a lot of folks would come in from the States looking for employment, just looking to start a new life. We've actually been getting a lot of inquiries from those that are in the States, and they would reach out and like, hey, I'm in Utah right now. I'm planning on coming over to Hawaii. Can you help me out with some services? You know, we usually try to give them the harsh realities of living out here. It's very expensive. If you do come here without a solid plan, you may end up finding yourself out on the streets. Not the most pleasant experience. We try to do as much as we can to educate them and let them know, you know, hey, if you do come to Hawaii, if you don't have a plan, you may be on the streets for a bit, right? Until something can happen, right? So, and that happens more often than not. So the whole medical thing, try to take a preventative measure before it gets to be a problem.
Well, thank you so much, all three of you, Sarah, Castro, and Angie, for coming in and letting us hear more about the Return to Home program.
Thank you.
Thanks.
That was Sarah Sato, Castro Masaniai, and Angie Knight from the Institute for Human Services talking about a program called Return to Home. The program relocated 137 individuals in its first year. Most went to extended family and detox centers across the continent where they can get long-term support. State lawmakers are considering whether to make this program permanent. Its funding runs out at the end of 2026.
A man described as a leader of a Japanese organized crime syndicate is on trial in the United States for trafficking nuclear materials from Myanmar.
Anybody who has heard about this case, their first reaction is that it sounds like it's out of a Hollywood movie.
High crimes, deception, and a deep dive into Myanmar's black market. That's next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for HPR comes from Leeward Theatre. Na Le Hulu Ika Veikiu performs Kupu Kupu, a new production featuring musical twists, March 15th and 16th. leeward.hawaii.edu/theatre.
The Kilolani Project at the Queen Emma Clinics has helped more than 300 patients manage their diabetes since 2021. All her are Native Hawaiian, and many of them homeless or otherwise vulnerable. A new focus group study credits the program's success with something called a patient navigator, and that person helps patients with everything from appointments to connecting with community resources. Dr. Nani Morgan helps run the program. She and patient navigator Uluwalohaana spoke with The Conversation's Maddie Bender about the new research and what the Kilolani Project is getting right.
Within our Kilolani program, one in four of our patients has a hemoglobin A1C greater than 9. And so we use the hemoglobin A1C as a marker of disease control. When your A1C is greater than 9, that really puts you at much higher risks of many of the complications that we see, kidney disease, heart disease, blindness, et cetera. We started our program in 2021. We are a multidisciplinary chronic disease management program, really centered around a Native Hawaiian patient navigator. Our team consists of a dedicated registered nurse, as well as a clinical pharmacist. And at one point, we also had a dedicated social worker as well. But ULU is really, all of our services center around ULU, I would say.
This is a great point for you to come in, ULU. Mm-hmm. Before getting involved in this project, mm-hmm. what did you know about diabetes management?
So my grandfather was diabetic. And so growing up with him, always having to, he taught me how to insert his insulin into his opu, his belly, you know. And so I always saw him taking care of his health, you know, and making sure that he had everything in order to help him thrive, you know, to help him live. And we were, my grandfather's fortunate to have such a supportive family. You know, and a lot of our patients, they don't have that support. And so that's what they're missing, is that relationship, that family member. So that's what the Keyline program basically is, right? We're like an Ohana program, and we help with making them feel secure.
We do try to track clinical metrics, right? So people's hemoglobin A1C, what's their level of disease control? Are they getting in to see their doctors? Are they completing their labs on a timely basis? And we were seeing incremental improvements in those things. So we haven't published this data yet, but we've seen that the average hemoglobin A1C of our cohort has trended down by 0.8%, which sounds manini or small, but 1% decrease is actually associated with significant reduction in micro and macrovascular complications. So something to celebrate. Our patients were getting in to get their labs done on a timely basis. And this was all in the setting of the COVID pandemic and staffing shortages and telehealth, et cetera. And yet, you know, as a primary care clinician, someone who's listening and talking story with patients day in and day out, and I think ULU would say this too, we just didn't feel like the numbers alone were really capturing the value of our program and in hearing like the experiences and perspectives of our patients. I remember a couple years ago, after we showed some of our preliminary data relating to clinical outcomes, that our leadership was like, wow, okay, so what's the next step? We want to expand to all Hawaiians served in the clinic. We want to expand to Pacific Islanders. And I tend to be a little bit more cautious and analytical and like, okay, well, can we just maybe pause for a second and talk to our patients? Is this something that they're finding helpful? You know, if they could design the program, what would it look like to them? Where would they want to take it? And I think for me, that was really like the crux of embarking on this qualitative project, and why qualitative methods can be so valuable is to really center the voices of the patients that we're caring for, giving agency to this population that doesn't always have a voice, that's mm-hmm. often left behind, and finding solutions in them rather than from sort of a top-down approach.
ULU, maybe you could read off one of the representative quotes that you got from someone in the group and to let their voice
be
heard.
Okay, so this person said, and you know, she's like more of a sister than a worker, because you can tell her any time and say, hey, ULU, I got this problem, you know? Like, it's not only we are talking about things that happen here, but we are also talking like the whole thing about my life. You know, I say, can you help me with other stuff? And she's right there. I was raised illiterate, and so I didn't go to school. When I was in eighth grade, my mom took me out of school, you know, because of trauma that I went through. And, you know, ULU knew about that. So every time when I just need to talk, she's there. I still need her. You know, there's only a few people I trust.
How did it make you feel to hear that for the first time?
I get emotional all the time. I'm not going to lie. I was holding it in, but it makes me feel great. It makes me feel like I'm doing something right.
It makes us feel like we can never quit our job or end our program, because these patients that really have never found trust in other people and in people who, you know, have been through pretty horrible things, they found that in ULU. And I just think that's so, it's really incredible. Yeah. It was incredible to hear those stories. I mean, just within that quote, more like a sister than a worker. And we heard that from so many patients, you know. They come into their visit, the doctor's on the computer because we're all trying to like hit our quality metrics and make sure you got your COVID shots and your flu shots. But Ulu is able to talk story with our patients. She's able to spend time with them in ways that we can't always with mm-hmm. our productivity and efficiency constraints. And through that, develop these really beautiful relationships, or Pilina is just so central to what she does.
And that's the thing, right, that people talk about all the time, of trust in doctors and in the medical establishment. I know you shared that, like, it's difficult to scale up something that is so hyper-personalized, mm-hmm. but what are the common themes or the ways that you feel like you've been able to build that trust and build those relationships?
You know, honestly, I just feel like when you meet someone for the first time, you just don't judge them, and you just ask them, how's your day? You know, and that's when they start thinking or just expressing their feelings to you. And I remember in one of the groups, they said that's all they wanted. That's all they want, right, is someone to ask, how was your day? How are you? Because it means a lot to them, you know, versus someone asking, what brought you in today? Or I don't know. Mm-hmm. I know there was someone that mentioned that in one of our groups. And I think just taking like a few minutes of your day to just ask someone, you know, because you never know what they're going through. It's important. Yeah.
I just had a new patient come in last month. And so I went into my doctor mode of taking my initial patient H&P, history and physical. And I'm like, okay, I see that you have a past medical history of high blood pressure, diabetes. Oh, I see you're on this medication. And he was like, whoa, how much time you got, doc? I just want to, let me tell you a story. And we spent the full time together of him just telling me his life story. I left feeling like, oh my gosh, did I do my job? I didn't hit all the check boxes that I'm supposed to hit. What am I going to write in my note? But then when I look back at it, so many of our patients, that trusting relationship is so critical. If I don't spend that time up front, any medication that I prescribe to him, any, you know, CAT scan that I want to do for his lung cancer screening, why would he do it? Why would he trust me? You know, mm-hmm. It seems so obvious. And yet, time after time, patients, especially patients from Indigenous and Native Hawaiian populations, experience the healthcare system as lacking in empathy mm-hmm. and compassion and availability. And so that's what we really try to provide in having this patient navigator. I think in this system where, you know, there's this, again, this efficiency and productivity demands, that a patient navigator then is a perfect person to be a part mm-hmm. of that team-based approach, because they can really spend the time and also address the concerns that the patients want, you know, that, mm-hmm. that they're concerned about. Yeah. So a lot of our patients, you know, their A1C might be greater than 9, but they're like, you know, like they're concerned about
food.
Where do I get my next meal? Yeah. Or how do I fill out the Section 8 housing forms, mm-hmm. right? And until we sort of hear their concerns and address their concerns, nothing else really matters, mm-hmm. honestly.
Yeah, and I feel like in our focus groups, the patients really built the diabetes support groups, because they were telling us exactly what Dr. Morgan said, what they wanted, right? And we were just trying to brainstorm on how to pull it all together. And we've been doing, it's been great. You know, our patients are meeting each other for the first time, and they've established great friendships outside of the campus,
yeah,
which is nice.
So we just piloted our first 6 months last mm-hmm. year, and every educational session, it's held on a monthly basis. We include a culturally tailored evidence-based curricular piece, or like a core diabetes topic. We have 45 minutes of exercise, and without funding, we were just using water bottles as our weights. Mm-hmm. We're often seated because some of our patients are in wheelchairs and have disability. And then we've been adding like a cultural component and sometimes a patient-led component mm-hmm. where we've just done some kind of fun activities led by, you know, what our patients, where our patients take us, whether it's we've done lei making.
Yeah, la'olapa'au, the medicine.
Olena cough syrup. Yeah, we just did medicinal teas. They always are interested in more nutrition-based things, of like, how do we source things locally mm-hmm. That are affordable to incorporate more fruits and vegetables in our day-to-day diet.
Yeah. Final thoughts from both of you. Anything you want to leave listeners with about this program or the themes that we've been talking about more generally about trust in the healthcare system and in medical professionals, Dr. Morgan?
I mean, I just think for me, in our medical training, qualitative methods are not talked about a lot. But I think in working towards health equity, I think it's just so obvious and so critical to center the voices of our patients and really look to them for the solutions.
Right. And treating our patients like a family member versus like statistics, you know, our numbers, you know, our data. I think that's the most important part, or a lot of providers forget.
That was Dr. Nani Morgan and Ulu Aloha Ana of Queen Emma Clinics. We'll have a link to their focus group study on the conversation page of our website after the show.
Public radio, there's a phenomenon called the driveway moment. It's when you're driving somewhere and you reach your destination, but you linger in the car just so you can catch the end of a great story. Well, with the HPR mobile app, you can pick up that story anytime you want, replay national shows as well as local news stories, and make driveway moments a thing of the past. Get the HPR app in the App Store or on Google Play.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors PCAT, Pacific Center for Advanced Technology Training, and the Rice Partnership.
You're listening to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio, and today we've got the call of one of Hawaii's most common migratory ducks. University of Hawaii at Hilo Professor Patrick Hart introduces us to the Koloa Mapu. Here's your Manu Minute.
Koloa Mapu, also known as northern pintails, are one of the most widespread ducks in the world. They're considered to be indigenous in Hawaii, meaning they're naturally found here as well as other places. In Hawaiian, koloa means duck, and mapu means windblown, or wafted in with the wind, perhaps because they would regularly show up in Hawaii with the trade winds every August, making their very duck-like calls. They have particularly long necks and long, pointy tail feathers that really stand out and are what give this species their English name of pintail. Koloa mapu are sexually dichromatic, meaning males and females have different colored plumage. Males in breeding plumage have dark brown heads and a distinctive white line going up the back of their neck, while females are more of a mottled brown. They breed in the spring and summer from the west coast of North America up to Alaska and even Siberia. Like most other ducks, they lose all their flight feathers and can't fly for about a month soon after breeding. Then, when the new feathers grow in, they begin their long journey to their wintering grounds. In Hawaii, Koloa mapu may be found in any shallow freshwater or intertidal wetland habitat where they feed mainly on seeds, aquatic grasses, and invertebrates. Before 1960, they were reported to number in the thousands across the islands, but now average in the low hundreds, most likely due to loss of their wetland habitats. Protection and restoration of wetlands would likely lead to an increase in koloa mapu in Hawaii. For Hawaii Public Radio, this is Patrick Hart from the Hilo Department of Biology.
Support for Manu Minute comes from the Hawaii Audubon Society, connecting the community with the Manu o Ku through programs to promote awareness, appreciation, and conservation of the official bird of Honolulu. Learn more at hiaudubon.org.
When you support HPR, you support locally produced programs featuring locally produced music, including Kani Kapila Sunday.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Kani Kapila Sunday. I'm Kaylee Iloma, and I'm so happy to be with you again on a Sunday from 2 to 4 p.m. to offer you great Hawaiian music from all periods.
Hawaii Kula Iwi.
Aloha nui kako. You are tuned in to member-supported Hawaii Public Radio 1's Hawaii Kula Iwi. Ovo no keio, DJ Mermaid, Paige Okamura.
And Mauka Tumakai.
This is Mauka Tumakai. I'm your host, Roger Bong.
Your support brings the music of Hawaii to the world. Support Hawaiian and local music programs on HPR. Donate at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Now it's time to polish the answer to today's backyard quiz and let it shine. Earlier we told you about official state symbols here in Hawaii. The reef triggerfish is the state fish and the Kamehameha butterfly is the state butterfly. But did you know we also have a state gem? It earned this title in 1987 and it can often be seen off the coast of Kauai. It's a popular item for jewelry and carving, though it has gained status as a protected species. Luckily, this underwater living gem doesn't have too many predators, although parrotfish and butterflyfish have been known to gnaw on it every now and again. It grows in slow colonies and can take decades to mature, which makes over-harvesting a significant threat to these creatures. And like that tree in your backyard, its age can be estimated by its growth rings. If this state gem sounds more like an animal, it's because the answer we were looking for is black coral. There are more than 150 species of black corals found worldwide, and 14 are in Hawaii alone. And congrats to Mike from Kaimuki. You got it right. Mike shares that he loves the ocean and he loves to dive, and I'll be so jealous if you got to see black coral there. But that is our quiz for today. If you've got an idea for one to share, write to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. It has been 5 months since we lost Maui resident and musician Chris Christopherson. While his family and friends are still dealing with the loss of the prolific songwriter and singer, his fans are able to take comfort through a short documentary film about his life and career. It's called One Man, One Voice. It's been making its way on the film festival circuit in Europe, where it's picked up several awards. Take a listen to the trailer.
Don't look so sad. I know it's over. But life goes on, and this whole world will keep on turning. Let's just be glad we had some time to spend together.
I've been on the road with my band since 1970, and that's about three decades of being out there on the road. And then I took kind of a break. I had a heart bypass. It gave me a chance to sort of sit back and look at what was going on, and decided to go ahead and play it on my own with just a guitar and a harmonica. While it was different than playing with my band, it wasn't as much fun as playing with my friends all the time, but it put a focus on the songs that was good. At this point in what I'm doing, that's about the most important thing that I do while I'm up there, is just communicate the words of the songs.
Well, you fight like the devil to just keep your head above water. Chain to whatever you got that you can't throw away. And you're shooting through space on this river of life that you're writing. Hello, Maui.
Hello, Maui. Kris Kristofferson's time on the Valley Isle represents a chunk of the singer-songwriter's later life. We talked to film director Ken Martinez-Burmeier about the documentary. It's been well-received on the film festival circuit in Germany, France, and Italy, where it's picked up a couple of awards. It heads to Sweden later this month and makes its North American debut this weekend. Here's Burmeier.
We got accepted at the Berlin Indie Film Festival, and the film actually won Best Director. We were honored with that. We got notification about in France at the Cannes World Film Festival. They loved the films, and then we won Best Musical Film, which was quite an honor to get that. And then we got a notice from Rome in Italy. The Rome Prisma Film Awards selected, and they're doing an international screening of it as well. And we haven't heard about any awards yet, but they did select it. And, yeah, we're really excited about that. And then it's a Swedish International Film Festival contacted, and they're going to be screening it here in the next couple weeks. So we'll see what happens there. It's official selection. But this Saturday, it's the 25th annual Santa Fe Film Festival. So this will be our North America debut. And I was checking on flights, and it's, you know, thinking about maybe trying to, you know, get out there. They got filmmaker passes for me and the whole deal, and want me to do a Q&A, so I'm trying to put that together. But yeah, this Saturday we'll have the North America premiere of the Kris Kristofferson One Man, One Voice tribute film. So it's pretty exciting. We got in some other film festivals that reached out, London and Paris and some other, you know, Nashville. So we'll see what happens. It's kind of grown. It's, you know, it's out there in its journey, which we're really excited about it, honoring Kris. You know, he was such a beautiful and humble, loving man. You know, I was blessed to work with him.
Yes, you know, I think when you say, yeah, he's humble, that comes across.
Yeah, you know, I mean, if you watch a little film, you know, I lived in Hana for years and years, too, and you know, people just walk up to him, and like, you know, all the kids, everyone, he was just another guy, he was just another uncle, you know, and, you know, it was just so true, and, you know, he wasn't showy or anything like that, man, he just drove an old truck, and he was a really cool dude, man. We really enjoyed when he was out in Honda side with us, and he was always helping the community. And one reason I got in tied with this to do the documentary originally was an organization, a nonprofit called Ohana Makamai, which helps all the families in Honda, so, you know, women and children. And Kris said, how can we help? And we said, well, maybe we could do a live music type show and raise money for Ohana Makamai. And that's how I was brought in the loop to direct and produce it. And we filmed it at the Maui Arts and Cultural Center and then just wanted to, you know, broaden it and went out, you know, and interviewed Kris and talking about his journey and everything he's gone through over, you know, for decades. He was a star, his music career, then going to films. And you look at his broad amount of work he's done, it's amazing. To talk to the guy, he'd never brag about anything. He was really, really, you know, blessed to, you know, have someone like that and that stature of a celebrity, you know, just being a real guy, you know, a real person.
Well, tell us about the time period that you shot this film.
Well, we did the original thing. He did this, man, it's been about 14 years ago, something like that. Did the original long form film video. We filmed the whole project, raised the money for the Ohana Makamai, doing the DVDs. Ohana Makamai sold those, raised money. That was like a long form version, you know, well over, it was like 70 minutes or something like that. And then, you know, time's gone by, and then he passed away, and I remember getting a phone call like hours after that from Han, and it was really just shocked me. I went and revisited everything, all our film footage, because we keep everything in archives, and, you know, let's make a tribute. So we wanted to make a shorter version, it's about 18, 19 minutes, and we decided to do the, you know, the One Man, One Voice, Kris Kristofferson tribute. It's a short documentary film, and it's kind of grown its own legs, like, you know, the child has gone out there, you know, showing what a spectacular human being he was. Just really, you know, honored to be part of it. When he moved to Hana, you know, raised his family, he kind of, you know, left the mainland and found a love for Hana. It kind of reminded him, like, when his days growing up in Brownsville, Texas. He loved the people, the community, and the community embraced him as well.
I was enjoying listening to an interview that Dave Lawrence did with him. And I didn't realize that he became familiar with this region, I think because his dad had worked out one of the atolls for the military.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just really, you know, interesting just to hear that connection from, you know, little kid time.
Yeah, right. Yeah, his father was a military guy, and they had that experience, and then he came back out and then discovered how beautiful Hana was, how heavenly Hana is, and moved the whole family, raised his whole family out here. They all went into the whole school systems and through the whole process, all his kids, so... You know, it was an amazing journey, and, you know, it's sad he's gone, but that's where we wanted to reflect, you know, part of this tribute film with him. And hopefully we'll be doing some screenings here in Hawaii after it does its little film festival circuit, and we'll bring it back home and share it with our communities here, too.
I think it would be so nice, yeah, for folks here to get a sense of Uncle, right?
Right. Yeah, for years I did my Hana Film Festival for 10 years, you know, and he would always come out and hang with us. And a couple times I'd say, hey, Chris, can you, would you maybe play a little bit? He'd bring his guitar and get up on stage and play for the Hana community. And this is all for free. You know, having those kind of memories and stuff, it just kind of, he really touched all of us. And this is just our way to kind of just give back and kind of keep his name, his whole being out there, his spirit, keep it alive.
Well, now, do you have a favorite Kris Kristofferson song?
Wow, there's so many of them. there's so many. I mean, it really is. I mean, I remember when we were filming this, right? And a couple of my camera guys were like, wow, sung a whole bunch of those songs that of all these other people, like Help Me Make It Through the Night and Being Bobby McGee. And I go, wait a minute. He's the one who wrote those songs. The other big musicians made it famous, but, made them kind of think, wow, he did all those songs. Yeah, he was the original singer-songwriter. So there's so many, it's a vast, list. I mean, you go on and on, his songs. So kind of, I hate to do a favorite one, but I'm kind of like, I enjoy all of them. They all touch me on a different level,
Yeah, depending on kind of what you're going through, right?
Yeah, you're right. Whatever mood you're in, and he can, he'll take you there and dive deep in the problem and maybe solve it, or make you happy again, or make you really think about, what's going on, the issues that are going on in your life.
Well, what an honor, though, to get all these awards at these film festivals over there in Europe.
Yeah, it's amazing. The audience there, we just threw them out there, and also we just started getting phone calls. Hey, can you submit it here? And said, yeah, sure. So, yeah, it's sad that he's not here to be enjoying it with us. It'd be kind of cool, but he's here with us in spirit. But, we were just kind of keeping that light shining, and people really did, you could see they really love him, and they're selling tickets for the festival, for the screening and everything there, too. They're going to have full houses, they said, in the past in Europe, full houses, and Santa Fe is saying, oh, yeah, we got a lot of people want to come see it. So, yeah, it's been quite a adventurous journey, and just being able to work with him and share this with the world.
Well, if listeners want to keep tabs, of the schedule once you get things pinned down about future screenings here, is there a website we can drive people to?
Yeah, they can go to our, actually on Facebook, social. They can go to my, Kenneth K. Martinez Bergmeyer. I got my Facebooks out there, the pages, and Instagram, and we do have our jazzalleytv.com. You can check stuff there always. We're trying to update that. But social media, check us there and on a Hawaii on TV Facebook page. We've got about 100,000 followers there, so you can always check. We always post everything that's happening with the film and updates. So, we'll call you up. We'll let you know, too.
Okay.
Get it on the calendar. But, yeah, I really appreciate you kind of showing your aloha and showing, what you guys really thought of Kris, too.
I think, yeah, our listeners, enjoy his music, and it's nice to know about this. But thank you for sharing that with us as well.
Yeah, and everyone can, go on the Facebook. You can, again, hunt down the trailer. The trailer's out there.
Okay.
It's on YouTube. Just go. You can Google all that stuff, and it'll come up, and you'll see some of that process out there, too, see the film.
That was Ken Martinez Burmeyer talking to us from Maui yesterday. The film, a tribute to Kris Kristofferson, is called One Man, One Voice.
Shake it loose and let it fall.
Well, we have to go now, but up tomorrow, what can work in Vail and Aspen help Hawaii's affordable housing problem? We take a look at how deed restrictions can help avoid units sitting empty or used for vacation rentals. Leave us your feedback on our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. Look for the Conversation podcast on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.
I don't care.